Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines. This is your host, Eric Mann. Again, very happy to be back doing the show. And today our guest is Arison Agnos, who many of you know. He's also been on the show before. We're going to be talking about, with his 90th birthday coming up, a sort of a retrospective of his life and also his future thoughts about where his life is going. With a life as fascinating as long as yours, Aris, I mean, we're working off, first of all, a draft of autobiography. It's called The Passionate Odyssey of Aristides Anagnostopoulos, which is your full name. And I want to start in ancient Greece, because as you pointed out, my life began 2,500 years ago in ancient Greece, when my namesake, Aristides, was threatened with ostracism. So one of my questions is that you grew up in an affluent, cosmopolitan family with a great sense of capitalist ingenuity. Your father seemed to be a brilliant businessman and kept landing on his feet as many times as he could in the middle of all these crises. They often landed on their feet in the midst of war, poverty, and suffering. But how did that issue of growing up in privilege, exposed to so many different languages and cultures, but then also the impact of the Great Depression and the suffering others, how did that impact your life for better or worse?
Well, it did, and of course, all of Greek history did, and modern Greek history. But I became aware of the abuse of power very young. I was 13 years old when a dictatorship was proclaimed in Greece by a former general, Metaxas, and I could see the abuse of power by the dictatorship. So all my life, in a sense, I've been fighting the abuse of power by those in power, because power is something that leads to abuse very frequently. And it's always important to combat power and fight power against those abuses.
But that doesn't explain your unique biography, because as your father told you, Aris, there are exploiters and exploited, and I think it's better to be an exploiter because there's more money on that side. So why did you not choose that side in the war?
My father didn't know that he was spouting off pure Marxist philosophy.
But he just thought he was giving you good advice, right?
He thought he was giving me good advice. But I felt, because we were privileged and we were better off and there was so much poverty around us, I felt I had to fight poverty. Because I felt from that age on that it was unfair for me and for my family to be so much better off than the people around us.
I'm going to try one more time. There's still something I'm all trying to figure out, like myself as a Jew, certain things that happened to me in my privileged life that also began to make the change. Because there's very few people, Aris, if we put 100 people in the exact same circumstances you grew up in, frankly, there would only be one Arison Agnos. So is there anything you can think of, besides your DNA and your moral decisions, were there any events in your life that you think a light bulb went off besides seeing the suffering of others?
Well, of course, I lived through the Second World War, and I lived through the German occupation, the Nazi occupation of Greece, after Mussolini attacked Greece. And of course, there are three great periods of Greek history. There's the classic Greek history, there's the Byzantium, and then there is the modern Greek history when Greece reemerged as a modern country in 1821 after fighting the Ottoman Empire. And so there is a tradition of independence in Greece, independent spirit. And of course, Greece, after the First World War, was sort of a semi-protectorate of the British,
right,
under the control of the British, through financial control primarily. And all of those things sort of made me object as a Greek to being semi-controlled by a foreign power, in this particular case, England, before the war. And then came the occupation, and I saw the atrocities that the Nazis committed. I saw the famine. I saw people starving in the streets and the dead bodies being collected in the morning every day by horse-drawn carts, because there were no vehicles. The Germans had confiscated all the vehicles that were serviceable. And then I managed to escape from Greece and join the Greek forces of the Middle East. And that is where I became really radicalized. because there was a concern that the Greek forces of the Middle East would be used to bring the king back. The king was a hated puppet of the British.
Right.
And there was an underground organization within the Greek forces in the Middle East, which I joined. It was called the Anti-Fascist League. And it was under leftist leadership, of course. And we had some interesting experiences, including a mutiny, where we arrested our officers and we took control of the forces. I was in the 1st Greek Brigade, which fought in the desert campaigns, but all the other troops in the Middle East, including the Navy in Alexandria, these were the Greeks in exile. And 20,000 men really joined in a mutiny with one single demand. We demand free plebiscite before the king is brought back. And that was a demand. Of course, Churchill had declared that monarchy is the best form of government.
Right.
And he implies in his memoirs that the Greeks are going to have a king whether they like it or not. And of course, that's what we objected to. However, we, after having fought in the desert campaigns, we ended up in a concentration camp as political prisoners.
Well, I want to come back to one thing. It seems to me that as we move forward, that we'll still stay back in the concentration camp. But one of the things I, you know, knowing you pretty well, is you've done a lot of work with tremendous empathy for the revolutions in Nicaragua and the revolutions in Cuba and the revolutions in El Salvador for self-determination, not just for socialism. And I read in your draft of your biography that you say, after our glorious days in ancient times ended, we Greeks, having subjected to domination and humiliation by Romans, Ottomans, Italians, Germans, French, British and Americans, we've always fought back. We've always fought for freedom and democracy that were the founding ideals of ancient Greece. So is it fair to say that in many ways you grew up in a somewhat subjugated nation, and that gave you some empathy with other nations that are subjugated all over the world?
Yes, that contributed, certainly. And also in the Middle East, I saw directly the effects of colonialism. I saw British colonialism, French colonialism, Italian colonialism. Of course, the most ruthless of the three was the British colonialism. But all, of course, were ruthless if anybody asked for independence. But of the three, the French were perhaps emphasizing more their culture, being very proud of their culture. The French everywhere tried to spread French culture. As a matter of fact, when I was young, I was learning French and using French textbooks. And the French always referred to France as France the civilizer. And that's how they regarded themselves. And I saw that in Beirut, which had been a French protectorate between the First and the Second World War. And Beirut was called the Paris of the Middle East. But you could see the effect of French culture there.
Well, let's go back to the concentration camp. So you led a mutiny. You were 19 years old. You disarmed your officer. You thought that you were going to rise up and topple the monarchy in Greece, but instead you ended up in a concentration camp. What happened after that?
Well, after that, after the British established, the British fought a resistance in Greece. In fact, they withdrew troops from the Italian campaign to fight the Greek resistance. And there was a Battle of Athens, which lasted 33 days. And the British bombed the working class areas of Athens, something even the Germans hadn't done. But eventually, because the population had suffered so much, the resistance agreed to a ceasefire, and the British and the puppets, most of whom were collaborators of the Germans, insisted that the resistance had to disarm. And so the resistance agreed to disarm. But that proved to be a mistake because there was a savage repression after that. And people who were in the resistance were killed by death squads, they were put in jail, they were hunted like hunted animals. Having been in the resistance became a crime in post-war Greece.
Well, let me ask you a couple of things there that the, and you're listening to the voice of Aris and Agnos. A couple of things you said I thought were interesting. One is that the British were more afraid of the Greek left than the Nazi right and the fascist right in Italy. They, as the story you told, is that they moved troops away from fighting in Italy to try to suppress a democratic Greek revolution. Is that correct?
That's correct. Because Churchill had the ultimate goal of destroying the Soviet Union.
Right.
After defeating Germany, his goal was to destroy the Soviet Union. In fact, that is why he first tried to persuade Roosevelt to invade the Balkans, where he knew that the Allies would get bogged down and so that the war would be prolonged, bleeding the Soviet Union longer. When Roosevelt proved too smart to go for that, he persuaded Roosevelt to invade Italy instead of France.
Hmm.
Well, Italy was like the Balkans. It was a mountainous peninsula, which was easy to defend for the Germans. So that prolonged the war another year at the cost of millions of lives in occupied Europe and in the Soviet Union.
Isn't it true that one of the deals that was made is that, unfortunately, when Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill were, to some degree, dividing up into spheres of influence, in return for Soviet Union getting the Eastern European countries, that Churchill in particular was adamant that they would have power over Greece after
yes,
the war.
But we didn't know it.
Right.
The Greek left didn't know it.
Right.
And perhaps they would have followed a different path had they known it. In fact, it was hard to explain when the Red Army got to the border between Bulgaria and Greece and stopped at the border. They could have easily entered
absolutely,
Greece.
Absolutely.
But they didn't.
That's heartbreaking, huh?
Well, it was a message which we didn't get.
No, absolutely, absolutely. It's about the great powers, as I say, dividing things up. There's one quote in your book that says, you know, often the choices we make are not the choices we want, they're the choices we're given.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very important for a lot of people today who just think you can make up your life choices. You had real choices throughout your life, so you might not have liked them, but you made the best choice you could at any time.
I had to.
Right. Now, after the war, did you stay in Greece and stay involved in politics? This is, now we're talking 47, 48, 49. Where were you then?
No, I stayed in Greece for about a year.
Okay.
Working for the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. And I organized a union of the employees, the Greek employees. There was a very distinct class division between the imported employees and the Greek employees. Because UNRWA had made an agreement that the Greek employees had to receive the same salaries as Greek civil servants, whereas the foreign employees were much more well-paid and much more privileged. But after that, I had to leave Greece and come to the United States, and I came as a student to UCLA. I'm a UCLA graduate. But my first job in the United States was a dishwasher in a Simon's Drive-In restaurant over in East L.A., actually Olympic and Soto.
Were you good at it?
I was.
It's important, right? It's important. If you're going to be a revolutionary, you better be a good worker.
Right, I was.
It's good.
And then I sold pots and pans door-to-door and miscellaneous other objects and insurance, and I got into real estate.
Now, you come from a business-oriented family, so you got into real estate. At that time, how would you assess your social conscience? Would you say that your primary goal back then was trying first to be a successful business person, and then also you had political thoughts, or were you very political at the time? How would you understand
yourself?
Well,
I was very political from the very first moment. For example, if I was making any money, I would send it to my friends in Greece, many of whom were in jail. I would send them care packages. I would send them any assistance I could. Many of my fellow soldiers, number one, were killed by death squads or were executed.
Right.
But some of them rotted in jail, so I was trying to help them as much as I could.
So you were still, while you're in the United States, seriously, and you're building your career, you're going to UCLA, you're trying to figure out a professional career, but you're still very tied to the Greek left in some way and loyal to the people with whom you worked. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Well, it's a real important quality. You shouldn't underestimate that. Today, I talk to a lot of young people about giving money. And when I was in the New Directions movement, for instance, I was an auto worker and I made very good living. I made, you know, back then $12 an hour, $18 an hour overtime. But what I try to explain to the young people is we gave $300, $400, $500 a month to revolutionary organizations of auto workers. We funded our own revolution. We didn't get foundation grants for a revolution, you know. So the whole history of working and then giving some of your money away as an integral part of your politics is not built yet into the culture of the young people today. It's just not.
In fact, later on when I started making some money in real estate, people were teasing me, saying, how can a Marxist like you be interested in making money? And I always replied, the revolution needs money. So
yeah, and I would, if I was your press agent, I'd say, how the hell do you think Marx worked in the British Museum? Engels kept battling him. Without Engels, Marx would have been starving to death, right? And Engels' father ran a factory. So I totally agree with you. You don't have to justify that to me or to most working people. So you come to the United States. You're becoming successful in real estate. When did you meet Carolyn, your wife,
Carolyn? I met Carolyn in 1967, I believe.
Had you been married before?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me about your first marriage.
Well, I met a very nice young woman who was a fellow student at UCLA. We got married. In fact, I had two children with her. But later on, we drifted apart. Then I remarried another woman who was very active in Democratic politics. We were very active in the Kefauver campaign.
Really?
Was
that 52? What year is that?
This was the year that Eisenhower was elected.
I think. 52.
And, of course, all the establishment was with Stevenson.
Right, right.
But to me, Kefauver was the one who had more integrity. He had fought organized crime. And he was not a Cold Warrior. That was more important to me. Whereas Stevenson was the conventional Cold Warrior of the Democratic Cold War trend.
Well, let's stay there a minute, because when I grew up in Valley Stream, Long Island, my father was a trade union social democrat, anti-communist, very strongly pro-democratic. He loved Adlai Stevenson. Oh, my God. They loved Adlai Stevenson in 52 and 56. So when we got involved in the anti-war movement, we were shocked to see Adlai Stevenson appointed by Kennedy as the head of the United Nations delegation, screaming at Khrushchev over the Cuban Missile Crisis. So the fact that sweet old Adlai was in fact a very hardline Cold War guy, right?
Right.
So you're back with Kefauver. You have a new wife, second wife, right?
Yes.
And was she political?
She was. She was very political. In fact, I met her in the Kefauver campaign. But again, we drifted apart for a number of personal reasons. And then I met Carolyn. And we were married 33 years. Carolyn and I had an absolute identity of ideas. And Carolyn was with me on many of the very dangerous and risky missions in Central America, when we went to meet the leadership of the FMLN, the Salvadoran guerrillas who were fighting the American-supported right-wing dictatorship. Carolyn was along. I told her, don't come, it's too risky. She says, if you go, I go. If we die, we die together. That was Carolyn. And we met the leadership of the guerrillas up in the mountains of El Salvador. There were all kinds of ruses we had to use to get there. And we brought down a peace proposal, which we took to Washington, and we publicized in a press conference. But this was during the Reagan administration, and Reagan didn't want anything to do with peace. He wanted a military victory. He was a fanatical Cold Warrior. And this was in 1985. The civil war in El Salvador lasted until 1992. That's when the peace accords were signed. And then again, Carolyn and I brought another peace proposal to Washington, and that's the one that got the UN involved and resulted in the peace accords.
This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. We've been talking to Arison Agnos, who a lot of you know in so many different incarnations. If you're active in Americans for Democratic Action, you'd say, oh, sure, I know Aris. That's the guy in ADA. If you're active in the Central American Liberation Movement, oh, I know Aris, of course. He's the person who's done all the work. If you're active in Greek politics and European, oh, Aris, of course, that Greek revolutionary. But he's all those people and more. Very fascinating life. And so I'm going to just keep going back and forward and back and forward. But I'd like to stay with Karen for a little bit because I was fortunate to have met her, of course. Very powerful person. The two of you were a powerhouse couple. Must have been nice to have somebody at least as strong as you who has had all that level of energy coming back at you. What were some of the tensions between the two of you? What was, if you had any?
There were really no tensions because there was complete harmony. I don't remember any conflicts or any friction between us. We were always in complete harmony because we loved each other so much that it was precious to keep the other person happy. And we were both considerate of each other, so we were constantly trying to please each other. It was a perfect marriage. And it lasted 33 years. If she were alive, we would still be married.
No, I think that's beautiful, and I think that's very mature. To pay attention and value the person you're with, to try to make them happy all the time is a good thing, because it's a rough world out there. I knew Carolyn, obviously. I knew when I met you as a couple. You were kind of known as a couple. I met you through Americans for Democratic Action, but I also mainly met you in terms of the support of the FMLN, in particular about the El Salvador struggle. So why don't you, since we're going to talk about that, you take us to El Salvador for a minute, and with you and Carolyn again. Any stories there? What did you learn there? What were some of the experiences you had there?
Well, we made several trips. The first one, actually, was when we were asked, and this was in 1984, a contact of the FMLN. I was at that time president of an organization called the Humanitarian Law Project.
Right.
And we were asked to go look for a student leader, Claudina Calderon, who had been kidnapped in the streets of San Salvador,
right,
and had disappeared. But somebody thought that he had seen her in the jail of the Policía Nacional, the National Police. And so the request was to go and try to find her in the National Police jail. So we got letters from Alan Cranston and Tony Billinson and Paul Sarbanes and senators and members of Congress we knew, and we went to San Salvador. And there the ambassador's secretary said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry. We had a group of 10 people, 4 women and 6 men. The ambassador is very busy. He can't see you. But we have all these letters from senators and members of Congress that we have to give them a report. So the ambassador, Pickering, saw us, and he said, the new chief of police is a friend of mine. So come tomorrow, and in the vehicles of the embassy, we'll go to the national police and talk to him. And the men have to wear a tie and be very official. So we went the next day, and the chief of police was very courteous because we had letters from Congress, and he said, you can search my building, and if you find Claudina, you can take her with you. And we searched it for 2 hours, and we didn't find her. What we didn't know was, the number one, she was dead, but they had killed her. But there was a subterranean passage to the jail of the National Police, and we didn't discover that passage. But when we came back, Carolyn sent him some pictures to the chief of police, and we got an official letter on the stationery of the National Police with sabers and cannon and flags, all these symbols of power, saying, queridos amigos, dear friends, it was great to meet you. Anytime you're in El Salvador, I'm at your disposal. And this was a letter we used the next year when we went up into the mountains to meet the leadership of the guerrilla. because we waved that letter through all the military posts we had to pass, and they let us pass. We had no safe conduct or permission from the military. So this letter from the chief of police from the previous year was our safe conduct. Well, and that's how we got to the mountains.
Well, that's a very good organizer, because he just sent you basically a gratuitous thank you and they hope I never see you again. And you took the letter and looked at it as if it was an official invitation to come back. You took him at his word, right?
Right.
So that's very, very clever.
So that's when we came back with a peace proposal, which the Reagan administration ignored.
Well, speaking of fascism, I want to go back and forward. There's a beautiful passage in one of the first chapters of your book that I want to read. We're going to go back to 1936. We were in 1980. We're going to go backwards. Then on the 4th of August in 1936, on a beautiful summer day, I was passing by the Athens Olympic Stadium built for the 1896 Games that began the modern Olympic era. As I approached the bridge, which separated the poorer sections of Athens from the rest of the city, I saw armed soldiers with machine guns and other automatic weapons facing and blocking the bridge. I was shocked and upset. When I arrived home, I learned that Ioannis, how do you pronounce it? I'm sorry, Metaxas?
Metaxas,
a Greek general and our prime minister, had disbanded the constitutional democratic government and imposed a dictatorship patterned after Mussolini's Italy. Suddenly, photographs of Metaxas appeared in all the government buildings, commercial enterprises, and many private homes. The dictatorship came about because there were strong labor unions in Greece, and there were strikes and direct action in the street as a result of the worsening depression. Of course, the scapegoats were the communists. As a result, there were brutal repression. Known communists who didn't hide were arrested. The Communist Party was outlawed and went underground. There were thousands who were arrested. And there were leaders who were sent to prison exile on small islands that became prison islands. How old were you at this time? It's 1936.
I was 13 years old.
And you're in the Boy Scouts.
Yes.
And tell us how the Boy Scouts became a fascist, phalangist organization.
Well, because Metaxas was a great admirer of Mussolini,
right.
He dissolved the Boy Scouts and formed a youth organization which was patterned after the Balilas, which was the fascist youth organization in Italy.
Right.
And membership was compulsory. You couldn't stay in school if you were not a member of the Phalanges, which is what he called right. The organization. And, of course, there again I saw the abuse of power, because one of the fringe benefits of belonging to the Phalanges was to get cheap movie tickets for 2 drachmas. When the normal price of movie tickets was 15 drachmas. So the officers would take the good tickets in the first class movie theaters of Athens and use them for themselves. And for the rest of us, they would send us to the neighborhood theaters, which were the second class theaters. So that was an abuse of power. The other was this forcing people to display the photo of the dictator.
Right.
In their homes and their businesses, which was one of the abuses of the dictatorship. Of course, there were much worse abuses.
Of course,
the jails and the exiles and so on. The irony, of course, was that Mussolini later attacked Greece, controlled by his own admirer, this general Metaxas.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things in your book and in your life is the constant shifting of alliances with the only unifying theme is that the capitalists will betray everyone.
Right.
They will betray each other. They will certainly betray the working class. So anytime the working classes thought they were in a united front with the capitalists will use them only up until a point, and then at a certain point they'll support the democracy, at a certain point they'll support the monarchy, but they'll always support their own interests. The capitalists, they have a very good understanding of class politics. Let's move a little bit to the future. I have 2 questions. How are you understanding your own legacy? I'm so glad you're writing this, by the way. It's beautifully written.
Thank you.
I spent several hours with it, and I'm going to read it more. And you've had an amazing life. Tell us a little bit about the writing of the book.
Well, so many times when I've told stories about different episodes, people kept telling me, why don't you write a book? So I finally decided to write a book. And the more I got involved and the more I remembered episodes of my life, the more interested I became, and now I'm spending a considerable amount of time writing it, because it's a long life, and I've had many adventures, and both in the Second World War and the United States when I came here, the different jobs I had, and also in Central America. I mean, there was a very interesting story. I was involved in the campaign of Bill Press when he was running for the Senate.
Right.
And Bill Press, because he was anti-war, he was the Democratic, he was running in the Democratic primary, but he was running against Leo McCarthy, who was not a bad guy, but he was a conventional Democrat.
Right.
Bill Press was anti-war. He was against the wars in Central America. And so he even though he came from the media, he had been a commentator on Channel 7, he was totally excluded by the media. He couldn't get any publicity. Right then, Jesse Jackson came back from Beirut with a couple of Americans who had been jailed in Beirut.
Hmm.
And he got a lot of publicity. So we thought, why can't we do something like that for Bill Press? But we didn't know anybody in Beirut, but there was an American held in Nicaragua who had tried to smuggle arms to the Contras.
Hmm.
And we knew everybody in Nicaragua. So we contacted Tomas Borges, who was the last surviving Sandinista, founder of the Sandinistas.
Oh.
And Tomas immediately, and we told him that we proposed that there was an American named Jim Demby. And Jim Demby had landed a small plane full of arms and explosives and ammunition on a deserted Nicaraguan beach, hoping to meet some Contras. But instead of meeting Contras, he met a Sandinista patrol, which arrested him. And the Nicaraguans were going to put him through trial to prove once more that the Contras were instruments of the United States policy. So we proposed to Tomas Borges to release Demby to Bill Press, who was anti-war,
right,
as something that would benefit both Bill Press, but would also benefit the Nicaraguans. And he did that. So Bill Press brought back Jim Demby. We chartered a private plane at the Santa Monica Airport, and we brought him back. And there was a big press conference at the Los Angeles Airport. Every TV channel was there. Every radio station was there. And that's the only time Bill Press got any publicity. And then we went to Washington, and we had another press conference. And again, Bill Press said that the Nicaraguans, as a gesture of goodwill to the American people, have released this American, even though he violated Nicaraguan law by bringing in weapons and explosives. And a few days later, in the vote in the Congress to continue aid to the Contras, the aid to the Contras was defeated, if I remember correctly, by 5 votes. And some of our friends in Congress who were against Contra aid told us that this gesture by the Nicaraguans to release Demby to Bill Press helped them get a few colleagues' votes and defeat the aid to the Contra extension. That's why the U.S. government, trying to continue aid to the Contras, made a deal with Iran to sell weapons to Iran with the payment going to the Contras. And that was the origin of the Iran-Contra scandal.
So basically you're saying that you are the origin of the Iran-Contra scandal, that you forced the Reagan administration.
It was the Bill Press campaign that generated the Iran-Contra scandal by having enough votes in the Congress to defeat the continuation of the aid to the Contras by, I think, 5 votes.
Well, what we're saying here for a lot of our listeners and a lot of the younger listeners, you know, I mean, you have to understand about learning about reading history and having a feel for history, because I was born in 1942, and World War II for me is very real. I've studied so many books about World War II. I know it really well. I know all about I read a book called Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, which was back then at Cornell, just a very liberal, not radical, but still a very interesting, fascinating 700-page history book about just the complexity of the negotiation between the three of them. If you're listening to Aris and Agnos, one of the things you're understanding is, if I may say, Aris, your tactical sense, your understanding, there are a lot of people who are well-meaning, and I don't mean well-meaning as a bad word, but who don't push it through to figure, so what is the point of what I do? Why do I do what I do? So in your case, first, you are trying to develop a tactic, which is try to get Bill Press elected, and then you're trying to circumvent a press blackout, but then you're trying to do a legitimately good thing on its own terms, which is also going to help Bill Press. But in the process of helping Bill Press, you also actually contribute to a tight margin in Congress. So if our listeners don't understand that Congress cut off aid to the right-wing counter-revolutionaries, the Contras were in Nicaragua, right?
In Nicaragua, right. From the Honduran border.
Right, so the Contras were in Nicaragua, the death squads were in El Salvador. So they cut off the aid. So what does Reagan do in terms of alleged democracy? So he is back to the conversation we had. He says, all right, so we lost that vote. The hell with Congress. I will backdoor the money and create a front. I believe it was Ali North, right? Constructed his own quasi-military operations, covert, and they moved money from Iran to the Contras.
That was the payment for the weapons. They sold the weapons to Iran with the payment going to the Contras to substitute for the financing that the Congress had terminated.
Right, to circumvent the Congress. This is what I'm saying is that, you know, if we grow up and say, well, how does a bill become a law? Just understand that the ruling class says, well, if we win, it's called the law. If we lose, the hell with the law. We just circumvent it. So that's just another great story. Let me ask a couple questions about, is remorse anything that operates in your psyche?
Well, I still have that burning feeling for justice, fighting injustice. For example, to have the Congress cut off or reduce food stamps,
right,
is a crime. And it should be obvious to anybody it's a crime. But these people are people haters. They hate the poor, they hate the seniors, they hate the students, they hate the immigrants, they hate the women, they hate everybody. They're people haters. And they call themselves the conservatives or the Tea Party.
Right.
They should call themselves the People Hater Party.
Well, they certainly do, and maybe that can segue us into, where do you see right now the front lines of where you want to go with your life right now? What are you trying to do? Is there a part of you that's trying to cement your legacy? Is there a part of you that is also trying to figure out what the new frontiers are for your own work? Let's start with the cementing of your legacy. I want to say that the book is very important. It's not simply your personal story. It's not simply a good story. But we don't have a lot of people like you. We don't have long-distance runners who have operated all over the world. Once this book comes out, I'll do everything I can on Voices from the Frontlines to get our listeners to understand it. We'll do a book party about it. We got to get these books out because we have a new generation of young people who are not reading, and we have to rebuild the culture of reading. So this is just terrific. Take a minute there. What's the process of getting this published? How is that going to work?
Well, I hope that a few months from now that I will have finished it. And originally, I didn't do it for commercial publication. I did it as to hand out to my friends, to my family, my history.
Right.
But going through the machinations of the Cold War and so on, I find that there are lessons in it. There are lessons for people to see how we get into this perpetual war state, how we have candidates who, if one war is terminated, now we see Obama supporting the rearmament of Japan because he has discovered a new enemy, China.
That's right.
And we're back all over again to the rivalry between China and Japan. Japan, after the war, was a disarmed country concentrating on peaceful production and commercial success. And now with the encouragement of our government, the Japanese are rearming, and to have a new rivalry and a new future war between Japan and China. That's a crime. And I supported Obama originally very heavily, as much as I could, both by contributions and by time and by approaching people and so on. And I'm very, very disappointed.
The voice you're listening to again is Arison Agnos. He's summing up the first 90 years of his life. And and I think that the there's no way to explain the profound disillusionment with Obama. I mean, as bad as I thought, you know, as good as I had hoped he would be, and as bad as I feared he would be, I have to say he's exceeded my worst expectations. And in the sense of, as you said, this new concept that the United States is now saying we're an Asian power. What in the world does that even mean? How can the United States say we're an Asian power? As you say, provoking a previously disarmed Japan to rearm in a fight with China. China has no military threat to the United States, but is a commercial threat in a world imperialist power. China has originally developed as an export company, you know, doing things like taking Apple computers and essentially simply assembling them. But now China wants to build up its own manufacturing base. It doesn't simply want to be a center for low-wage labor anymore. It's having great influence in Africa, where the United States has totally abandoned Africa. China's been coming in and making some very fair, in some ways, deals with the Africans to rebuild their infrastructure. So here we have all this massive poverty in the United States, and the best that Obama can come up with is to try to foment a war between not just Japan and China, but with Japan as the proxy for the United States. Would you say that's accurate?
Yes.
So what are you going to do about it, Aris?
Well, I think we have to continue the fight. We have to support those members of Congress, like Alan Grace, for example, or people who are progressives, true progressives. I was very disappointed when Barbara Boxer was gung-ho to start a war with Syria.
Right.
Now, there's no question that the president of Syria is a criminal. He has massacred his own people. But that's no reason for the United States to start another war. And I was very disappointed in seeing Barbara Boxer support that and some other people who we consider liberals.
Well, I think that's why you need to support social movements more than elected candidates, because the social movements stay close to their own ideals, and the elected officials, no matter how much money we give them, they rarely, rarely carry out what we ask them to do. Going back a few minutes, though, to your book, you said originally that you were just thinking of that sort of as an internal document, but were you implying that there now is a plan to get it published?
Well, I'll publish it, and I'm talking to somebody who says there is a publisher who will come up with 1,000 copies first, and if there is, I mean, I can give away 1,000 copies to
right.
friends and so on.
Right.
But if there is demand for more, he can print more. This publishing company will print more. So you don't have to make a commitment for a big number to be published. If people are interested, then you can have reprints.
Well, that's a good way to go. Plus, you know, you can get it on Amazon. They will take, Kindle will take online, digital, you see how well I understand the digital age, but Kindle will take a book that hasn't been published by a commercial publisher and still have it available on Amazon. So that's another thing. And I'll certainly say that when the book is published, that we'll have you back on Voices from the Front Lines. I'll support from the Labor Community Strategy Center. We'll do an event for you because, not as a favor, because this is going to be a very, very important book, and we want to rebuild the culture of books. You know, next week on the show, we're going to have John Sayles, his new film called For the Sisters, which is just coming out. It's with Edward James Olmos. It's with Lisa Gay Hamilton. I don't know yet the politics, but you know, if it's a John Sayles film, he did The Return of the Secaucus 7 millions of years ago. He did Matewan, a wonderful film about labor unions. He did Lone Star, terrific. He did Liliana, a film about one of the first lesbian films that portrayed lesbians in a coherent and attractive manner. And he did Latino, and now he's going to be on next week. So, Aris, we have 1 minute. So, Aris, what would you say in your last minute is your most hopeful thought for yourself for the next 10 years?
Well, I can't stop doing what I'm doing, which is fighting injustice. And that's what I've dedicated my whole life, and that's what I will continue doing as long as my health permits it and my personal resources permit it.
I think that's why you've done so well and why you're still here. I think it's much better to wake up in the morning doing good than doing evil. And you're a really tremendous force. I want to say this to our listeners. Your vitality, the consistency of your life, the anti-imperialist focus, the support for direct organizing, the support for electoral reform, support for struggles all over the world, your internationalism, your good sense of humor. You're a good guy, Aris. Let's just say it. And there's not that many people we can say that to. So it's been a pleasure having you on the show. As I said, when your book comes out, we're going to have you back on to plug the book. We'll have a book party for him. When is your 90th birthday party? Is it open to the public or is it...
No, it's not open to the public.
Okay, so I won't tell them the address?
It's by invitation.
All right, so folks, if you don't get an invitation, don't crash the party, okay? This was the party today. You were invited to the... This was the pre-party that you came to. So you've been listening to Voices from the Frontlines. This has been your host, Eric Mann. I think you know this has been your guest, Aris Anagnos. I want to thank G, our terrific board operator and producer. I want to thank Julian Lamb, who's been filming the show today. So we're going to do a little bit of a collage of some of Aris's statements. I want to think of all of you out there who are doing really excellent grassroots work, because this show is called Voices from the Frontlines. So the only people we have on the show are people on the front lines of trying to make history. I'll see you next week. Have a really good evening. This is Eric Mann, Voices from the Frontlines. Take good care of yourselves.